That was the arm he pinned over my head against the car after he spun me around to face away from him. My left arm has a dark contusion above the wrist, the arm he twisted behind my back to immobilize me. Then he'd used his pelvis to hold it in place, freeing his arms to grab hold of my neck. There is slight discoloration ear to ear. It hides in the shadows unless I tilt my head back, which I do now, to see how far I can let it go before the injury is exposed. Wade folded his forearms there, on either side. Then he jerked my head back into his chest so he could press against my carotid arteries. That's why there is soreness in the muscles. I'd fought against him, but my neck was no match for the strength of his arms. Finally, my hips, one with a bruise, one with a protruding vein. I think these are the worst of the injuries. Standing before the mirror, observing myself, naked and exposed, my precious ones just beyond the door, the bruises map out the assault. It happened in an instant. It lasted less than a minute. It was stunning, in the sense that it stunned me, caught me off guard, unaware, unsuspecting. The miraculous connection, the answer to my question setting me free. He had seemed genuine in every way, even in the psychological damage that had been done by the trauma we both endured. And yet, suddenly, he had become violent. The worst injury might actually be inside my head. I followed a stranger to a secluded road. I let my need drive me and override the danger I knew was there. I knew it, and yet I ran right into it, a head-on collision. Mitch is here now, knocking softly. Can I come in? I reach for the robe that hangs on a hook and pull it around me, tying it tightly with a sash. When we're alone behind the closed door, he holds me, and I feel myself give in. He doesn't ask for details, which means he's spoken to Rowan. Instead, he asks me why. It isn't like you to take that kind of risk, to put yourself in danger. How do I begin to explain what led me to that back road? I hear Landon in my head. I need to tell him. I start at the beginning. The shot that killed Clay Lucas and my doubts about whether I'd had to take it. Then the man who disappeared. How fucked up I've been since that day. Why didn't you tell me sooner? I give him the only reason I have. I didn't want you to see me the way I did. Mitch hangs his head and runs his hands over the beard. I wonder now if the beard is helping him hide what he's been feeling these past 2 weeks. I let you go through this alone. I didn't see it. He takes me in his arms again, and I listen to his heart. Tell me what you need, he whispers. I'll do anything. He's said this every day since the shooting, and I've never answered because my needs were beyond his reach, and now I finally told him. But where is the watershed of feeling? Why do I still not feel him? I hear a scream inside my head, telling him to take it away, to be my protector, to erase what's happened. He managed to do that after the affair, cordoned it off, so when we were like this, holding each other, we were skin to skin without a trace of Brianna between us. I'm no longer numb, but something new has come between us, and I still can't feel him. Not the way I used to, before the shooting, before the assault. What has Wade done? I wonder now not only what is inside him that made him turn violent, but what is inside of me that I followed him, put myself in danger, and what is inside my husband that he can't reach me. I feel Mitch's chest rise and fall as he holds back something that wants to come pouring out. Anger at Wade, frustration at me, impotence within himself that he can't make it all better. And I think back to what I said in Landon's office about never really knowing anyone. I want it back. I want us back the way we were before I walked into Nichols to buy towels, before I followed Wade Austin to that back road. I want to breeze about the kitchen, cleaning up after dinner, rattling off the facts of a new case, or hearing about his late supply deliveries or a funny anecdote about the whims of the wealthy. Someone wanting marble imported from Italy or a light fixture exactly like the one they saw at some dinner party. I knew the things that made him laugh to himself because he told them to me and only me. And he knew how my cases churned inside, the rabbit holes I went down and obsessed about. He would take me in his arms and tell me all the ways he would pull me out of them, his hand running up my thigh, knowing just where to touch me. I want it back. I want it all back. I pull him tighter, my arms around his neck, but I can't get through. Mitch leaves, takes the girls downstairs, and I move slowly through the bedroom, putting on sweats, brushing my hair. Finally, Rowan calls. I grab the phone, my heart already racing. Tell me.
Where are you?
He asks. He's out of breath, walking somewhere. I'm home, with Mitch and the girls.
Is the detail outside?
I go into the hallway and the window that faces the street. I see the black SUV parked two houses away. I tell Rowan, yes, they're here. Ask him what the hell is happening.
I'm sending you something. Open it.
My hands tremble as I pull the phone from my ear and open his message. There's an image attached, a picture of a man I've never seen before, with gray hair and a double chin, easily past 60. Who is this? Rowan is back inside the station. I hear the familiar sounds of phones ringing and people talking.
That's Wade Austin.
Chapter 8. The Kill Room. The forensics team finds nothing useful at the shelter except the rifle under the counter and the red jacket. Traces of OxyContin are found in the pockets. There is no hair or other biological material on either. The bones found in the cremation oven are damaged. They provide insufficient DNA sequences to run through CODIS. They have assembled the teeth and can match them to an X-ray once they have a lead on the possible victim. They do this in a matter of 3 days, even with a backed-up lab. They focus next on the behavior of the criminal, because that's all they've got. The execution of the crime was meticulous, but also unusual. The way many surfaces were not wiped for prints, only those the perpetrator touched. The doorknobs at the entry to the shelter, the basement, the cremation oven, the rifle and mount beneath the counter. The only area wiped clean in its entirety is the kill room. That, and the removal of the plastic sheeting on the floor, solidify their belief that the victim was killed there, rolled into the plastic, and dragged down to the oven. One of the state investigators is interested in the tire tracks, or the lack of them. So she has the team measure the marks that are left behind, the parallel lines spaced evenly 5 feet wide that pulled up the dirt and leaves along the clearing that leads to the shelter. She finds it quirky and eventually discovers that the marks were left by a pull rake. These are used not by farmers, as the team initially presumed, but by homeowners with tractor mowers who want an easy way to remove debris from lawns. They are lightweight, and some are retractable. They can collapse into a small size and be stored in a shed, or the back of a truck. The team traces the manufacturers and retailers that sell them, but finds the list prohibitively expensive. Anyone, anywhere can order one online, brand new from Amazon or any major hardware store, Home Depot, Lowe's, etc., or used ones from an even longer list of sites, Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace, eBay. There were also forums like Quora and Pinterest, where people sell things to one another directly. No. That was a dead end. What becomes more interesting is the type of person who would know about using a pull rake to destroy evidence of tire tracks. It wasn't an obvious choice. Most criminals altered their tread with chains or other devices. But of course, those attract attention on a well-traveled, paved road. The team searches for similar cases on every database they have. They call other departments and ask actual human beings if they'd come across something similar. They find a hit in a newspaper article from the Denver Post several years back. It comes up with the keywords murder, tire tracks, and pull rake. In that case, a man killed his estranged girlfriend and left her body in a pile of dirt off a highway. It was miles between exits, towns, rest stops. There was no reason for anyone to go looking. He didn't even bother to shovel a little dirt over her to show some effort at a burial for a woman he supposedly loved. When asked about this, he said he wanted the vultures to get to her. He said he thought about them pulling at her flesh, and this prolonged the revenge he had taken when she got the restraining order. Fucking bitch. But after he drove home and was cleaning off his truck, spraying down the dirty tires with a garden hose, having to work into each groove to get them clean, it occurred to him that if there was that much dirt caked into the tread of his tires, there would be tracks off the side of the road leading right to the body. If, and it was still a big if because his plan was so clever, someone did find the body, maybe because of the vultures, they would surely see the tire tracks. He first returned at night with a hand rake, parked the truck a mile up the road, walked back to the place he'd gone off-road, and started to erase the tracks by hand. Anyone who's raked their own yard knows that raking is hard work, and he soon grew tired and frustrated. Back home he went, to his computer, where he Googled the problem and discovered the versatile pull rake. He picked one up at a nearby garden store, waited for nightfall again, then erased his tracks in under 20 minutes. One more cleaning with the garden hose, a trip to the local dump to get rid of the pull rake, and he figured he was good to go. What he forgot to do was remove his search history from his computer. Within 2 days of the girlfriend's disappearance, he became the prime suspect, as he knew he might, given their relationship. His house was clean, his truck was clean, spotless clean, in fact. But then, there it was, the Google search. After that, it was simple deduction. Finding the garden store, searching the dump, tracing the soil. It took 6 days of driving roads lined with that kind of soil to spot the parallel lines, 5 feet wide and evenly spaced. But once they did, it was game over. The question that came next was this: who would know about this case all the way out here in Connecticut?
Chapter 9. Reality sets in before the sun rises. The pain from the bruises wakes me. I sneak out of bed to see them in the bathroom mirror. They are darker today, which I expected. Still, it feels unexpected, exposing the chasm between intellectual thought and emotional turmoil. In my brief sleep, I had erased the facts that I did not want to be real. They are back now, bringing a new struggle between exhaustion and adrenaline. I feel like a fugitive who's been on the run for weeks, first from myself, and now from this man who called himself Wade Austin. I take 2 ibuprofen and get dressed for work, even though it's only 4 a.m. I think I might get away with a silk scarf since fall is here. I have to dig it out from the back of my closet. I haven't worn a decorative accessory since my teaching days, but it covers the discoloration around my neck. I head down to the kitchen. I have not asked whether the attack has interrupted my plan to return to work, whether it has raised new concerns about my fitness for the job, whether I need to go back to see Dr. Landon. Unlike the shooting, there is nothing in our guidelines that requires a delay or more head shrinking under these circumstances, and I suspect Rowan will advocate for my return. He knows I will fare much better if I'm allowed to help solve this new puzzle of Wade Austin. Confusion has morphed into understanding about the situation. The real Wade Austin is an employee at Shield Insurance. The man in the blue truck, the man who assaulted me, the tall man from the shooting, is now a ghost. The number he dialed from my phone was from a burner. Untraceable. The man whose name he used has no digital footprint, no social media, and no photo on the firm directory. He was a bookkeeper, not a salesman, so there was no need to have him on the company website. As Rowan said yesterday,
Wade Austin was just a guy with a name that's impossible to search.
Rowan told me how they went through everything, the whole list of questions we ask people who have had their identity stolen, about IDs and credit cards, about new friends, theirs or their family members. Wade Austin is married with two grown kids, and he called them while Rowan stood by. He checked his credit cards and bank statements while our office ran his social security number for any loan applications or title searches. His identity wasn't stolen. Just his name. Just as a cover. There was no way to know how long the tall man had been using it. They went through other possible leads and came up empty-handed. There was nothing found on me or my car, no fibers or skin or hair. The flowers were cheap and came in no wrapping, probably from a grocery store. Rowan sent me photos of blue trucks, hoping I could narrow the search by make or model or even the shade of blue. But I had not been focused on the truck. There might be something on the surveillance cameras from the parking lot at the station yesterday to compare with what they had from outside Nichols. Maybe we could get a glimpse of the license plate sticker taped inside the back window. Maybe we could get an expert to ID the make and model. Lots of maybes. An hour later, I'm still in my kitchen, the sky pitch black, wearing the scarf, two bags of frozen vegetables pressed to my hip bones. I stare at a cup of coffee, piecing together what happened on that deserted road, seeing it in flashes of fragmented moments. I try to distance myself, to see it as a case, one we've just pulled from an old file. What would we notice? How he turned on a dime when he stopped believing that I trusted him. When he lost hope that he could forge some kind of connection between us. Was this what Dr. Landon had warned me about? The worship of rescuers? The need to believe that something larger than chance had brought us together? Because then the horrors of that day would not be random, but purposeful, preordained. Random acts implied they could happen again for no reason and with no warning. They could happen walking to the park, or going to a movie, or shopping for pants at a department store. Or was it something deeper? A personality disorder? A dissociative psychosis? A more dangerous pathology? He accused me of knowing things about him. He'd cast himself as a hero, willing to draw fire to save those who'd run or hidden, to save the pregnant woman. Did he believe this? Or was he using it to pull me in? I search online and see that Rowan is right. Nothing comes up for Wade Austin except a bare-bones LinkedIn profile. The last name, Austin, makes it impossible to home in beyond this. He's an insurance employee. If I take away that one word, insurance, I start to see every man named Wade who lives in Austin, Texas. I get pulled deeper into my mind by the growing fear of this stranger I let into my world. The clock ticks on the wall above the sink. The sky turns from black to blue with the rising sun. The frozen peas and carrots have thawed. I put them back in the freezer. The swelling has gone down, so I wipe off my skin with a dish towel, zip up my jeans. I'm good at thinking, I tell myself. I learned to channel the disquiet in my brain. Now it's my job. It's what I've done as a teacher, and before that as a student. Spinning thoughts, tornadoes, rabbit holes that have no end, burrowing deeper and deeper into darkness. But sometimes they lead to the truth. I go back to the beginning, to why I followed Wade Austin out of town. It was basic. Primal. The screaming toddler that had hijacked my brain. Human need. Every crime I've ever studied, every crime I've ever solved, every story I've lived and heard about people hurting people, it all funnels down to this one concept. The need for love, the need for money, the need for revenge, the need for justice, the need for safety, self-defense, the protection of others, the need for power, the need to protect pride and ego, the need to soothe some beast inside. A beast of anger, a beast of fear, a beast of disquiet, a beast of pain. What I needed from Wade scares me. The chorus had been loud, telling me it was irrational, that I had done everything right, regardless of the unanswered questions about Clay Lucas and his reason for firing his gun in that store, that it was just my anxiety taking control. I didn't listen, not to Mitch or Rowan or Dr. Landon. What I did to satisfy that need is terrifying. But the question lingers in my mind. What had this man needed from me? His crime against me does not feel like the place to begin this investigation. A stripe of orange appears at the edge of the sky that I see through my neighbor's backyard, just as I hear heavy feet come down the stairs in the front of our house. They stop in the foyer outside the study, then continue, growing closer. Mitch joins me in the kitchen. He looks surprised.
I thought you'd gone to the sofa, he says.
I shake my head, and he pulls me into an embrace. He'd held me through the night, and for the first time since the shooting, I'd stayed in our bed. I run my hand down his back, press my face into his shirt. He sighs before releasing me.
There's coffee, I tell him.
He pours a travel mug to the top, screws on the cap.
Is that for the girls?
He asks, peeking behind the scarf to see the bruising. And the office. They don't need to know the extent of it. He moves through the room, grabbing a power bar and a water bottle. Mitch is a proud man, but he knows he can't get involved. He knows Rowan and the rest of the department will be looking for Wade with resources he can't begin to match. None of this placates him. He needs to do something more than hold me while I sleep.
Hey.
I stop him as he begins to turn away.
I couldn't get through this without you.
His expression grows weary with frustration, both at his powerlessness to help me and my insistence that he is. He knows he's not. He knows he can't. We share one last hug, and he kisses the top of my head as we let this sink in. I wonder how much of this our broken teacup can hold. I follow him to the front door. We kiss, and he walks down the path to the driveway where he gets in his truck. I see the unmarked detail parked down the street. Our houses sit on quarter-acre lots. We all know when someone's kid is home from college or someone else's in-laws are in town, and we all have garages and driveways. The street is usually clear. The cops stand out like a sore thumb. I don't linger. I go back inside and think that maybe I'll make muffins for the girls to have after school like I promised them, and that maybe I'll make a fresh pot of coffee, and that I can't do this now. Worry about our marriage. It's been 4 years, and I still react at the slightest provocation, anxiety taking over the rational part of my brain. I take the coffee from the bag in the freezer, close the door, turn to the counter and the coffee maker. A flash comes then. A memory of the conversation I had with Wade before he turned angry, violent. When I was lost in the moment, the euphoric relief when he told me I did, in fact, save his life, that I did have to shoot Clay Lucas to save him. And then the frenetic outpouring from both of us about what we saw and felt that day and what it's done to us since. I told him things that went beyond the shooting and its aftermath. About sleeping on the sofa and how I hadn't done that for 4 years, and then Wade asked me, why were you sleeping on a sofa 4 years ago? And my answer,
fuck.
I stand now, paralyzed as I drag the memory from the place it wants to hide.
Because my husband had an affair.
What else? I force myself to remember. Her name was Brianna. He was remodeling her house. His father had just died, and I had a baby and a toddler. I've forgiven him.
And then, still, you must hate her.
Yes, sometimes.
Of course you do. That's human. Just like I hate Clay Lucas, even though he was sick.
I don't hate Clay Lucas. I hate the person who put that gun in his hands.
The conversation plays as I stand in the silence. The things I told Wade, that I confessed because he mirrored those confessions, matched the vulnerability they created. I needed to relieve myself of them so desperately that I ignored the alarm bells, and he played on that need with an instinct that now seems predatory. Suddenly, I hear another set of footsteps on the hallway upstairs.
Fran racing to my room to see if I'm in my bed, if there's still time to crawl under the covers for a morning cuddle against a warm body. My heart sinks, knowing she'll be disappointed, and now I realize I've also forgotten about the muffins. I turn on the oven, pull out the mixing bowl and baking pan. I call out, my head turned to the opening that leads to the front hall and then the stairs to the second floor. I'm in the kitchen! The feet move again, down the hall and then the stairs. I quickly pour flour, eggs, milk into the bowl, sugar, butter, baking soda. I find a bag of chocolate chips. Despite the chaos in my mind, I follow the recipe I know by heart. I see her in the doorway, a little bundle of crazy curls and sleepy eyes and pink pajamas. Her blanket is still clutched in her hand. Good morning, I say, lifting her. She wraps her legs around my waist and her arms around my shoulders and presses her face into my neck. Intense pain shoots through the bruises on my hips. What's this? She asks me, feeling the silk against her cheek instead of my skin. I put her down, remembering the bruise, remembering the back road, remembering Wade. I thought I would look nice on my first day back. She is quickly distracted by the bag of chocolate chips. She claps and jumps up and down. Are those for breakfast? She says as she looks at the muffin tin. You wish, I say. She sits at the table, and I bring her a bowl and a box of cereal. I get the milk from the fridge and some blueberries that will likely remain untouched. They're for the snack I promised to have ready for after school. Kelly will be here today, remember? She says okay, and pours her cereal and watches me mix the batter. I need to wake Amy. The bus comes in half an hour, and she likes to take a quick shower, then carefully consider her wardrobe choices. And just as I have this thought, I hear my phone chime. I stare at it on the counter. Fran stares at me. Mommy, your phone, she says. I look from Fran to the counter and slowly walk toward it. I don't recognize the number. There's a text message, which reads simply, nice scarf. And my heart stops. He was out on my street when I opened the door, kissed my husband. He was outside my house, watching me, watching us, with a police detail parked right there. I look at Fran. I think about Amy asleep upstairs and Mitch on his way to work. My family. God. No.
Mommy?
I take her hand and pull her away from the table. Let's go wake Amy, I say. I need to have my girls in my sight, in my arms. Fran doesn't ask why I take her with me. She follows, instinctively aware that something has just alarmed me. Suddenly, I feel a new need, one that is more powerful than the search for answers that brought all of this upon me and my family. The need to make him stop. Chapter 10. The texts come rapid fire as I get Amy dressed and fed and drive both girls to school. The principal is informed and alerts the security guard, who now watches the entrance with more care. There are already cameras and door alarms. The school is a virtual prison. We're in the same state as Sandy Hook, and the precautions put in place after that horror are now routine. My boss, Sergeant Aaron Berg, agrees to add one unmarked car as well, and I fight the urge to have the place locked down by the National Guard. I don't want to alarm the children, and there doesn't seem to be a need to take additional measures until we know more about this man. Still, it's not easy to drive away. I remind myself that I'm the one he wants, and so my children are safer away from me. His messages sway and swerve like a car with no one at the wheel. I just want to see you. We are connected. You can't change that. Don't believe their lies. Why won't you answer me? Answer me. Bitch. Cunt. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say those things. I need to see you again. Mitch wants to take us all away. But where, I ask him. We're safer here with the detail and the department and the neighborhood that knows us. Rowan is a live wire when I reach the station. He meets me at the elevator on our floor. Let me see. He reaches for my phone and reads the messages. Then his eyes turn to me and the scarf around my neck. He was outside the house, I tell him. He must have seen me then.
We walk quickly to our shared desk, where I set down my bag, but we don't stop. We continue to the back corner, where Aaron waits for us in his office. The squad room is a large, open space, except for one row of enclosed rooms against the back wall. One for conferences, one for interviews, and one for Aaron. We work at shared desks and behind cubicles with computers and files, and there is normally a buzz that never stops from phones and machines and people. I don't hear anything today. Maybe because my return and what is now happening to me has silenced my colleagues. Or maybe because I can't hear anything beyond the fear that rings in my ears. Aaron stands as we come in.
Elise, he says, how are you holding up?
It's been less than 24 hours since I followed a blue truck to a back road where I laid myself bare to a stranger, where I was assaulted and left choked out in my own car. I can still smell the flowers he left in my lap. And now this, the texts. He isn't going away. I think about the moment I walked out of Landon's office, how the shooting was already being forgotten since no one was shot besides the shooter. How everyone was satisfied with the conclusions about the kill, my kill, and had moved on. Except for me and my inability to live with the unknown. My unrest. The emotional turmoil that caused me to follow that truck and engage with an unstable man. This was my doing. I brought this man into my life. Our lives. I'm okay, I tell him. Where are we in finding Wade Austin? I realize I called him Wade, but that's not his name, and a gust of concern passes through the room. What are we calling him then? No one's decided this because it's only just begun, this new investigation. A moment passes before Rowan finally breaks the silence.
He's a 404, he says.
A 404 is a missing person, but it also has another meaning in our squad. Someone who is worthless or pathetic. We throw it around here as a joke among colleagues or to derogate a suspect. Rowan is taking this personally, which means we're both emotionally charged. I don't know where that leaves us. One of us has always been on steady ground. We usually aren't triggered by the same types of cases. But this one has us both unhinged. Aaron motions for us to sit, and we all take chairs. Rowan leans forward, elbows on knees, fists laced together and punching the air. His anger has nowhere to go. I sit perfectly still as my mind spins, searching for rabbit holes.
First things first, Aaron says. Vera Pratt is coming in this morning to help with the facial composite.
Vera Pratt is the pregnant woman who was in the dressing room with Wade.
Between the three of us, we should have something close, Rowan adds.
I remember now that Rowan saw him briefly, just before he left that last stall, the one with the closed door. My phone chimes.
Is it him? Aaron asks as I pull up the screen.
More of the same, I tell him. They've been coming in pretty steady all morning.
Rowan catches him up. It's a burner. Untraceable.
Aaron nods, tells me my number is now being fed to a technical unit that will monitor the messages. They can look for patterns in his words, check each phone he sends them from.
Just let them come, he tells me. Let's keep him talking, try to get a profile. Maybe he'll give us something we can use.
I nod and silence the phone.
For now, do not respond. Nothing. Let's see what he does. If we can't get an ID from the composite, we'll move to a protocol for engagement.
Yes, I think. This is all by the book. All of the things I know to do as a cop, but now have to live as a victim. A target. First came the self-loathing, because I'd made myself vulnerable. Then the humiliation of a forensic exam. Then the anger. Now, the fear. The helplessness. It overwhelms me as I try to focus on the instructions and the case I am about to dive into. They push and pull inside my head. Raw, hot emotions, and the knowledge of what needs to be done, calmly and with precision. There, too, is the uncertainty about Clay Lucas and whether I needed to take that shot. But that is now pushed aside to make room for these new emotions. I know it will come back.
Aaron continues. We've got nothing from the station lot, but the blue truck was parked in the Nichols Strip Mall. There's a nail salon and toy store that might have more security footage. We're going to see what we get from that. Maybe there will be a better angle of the plate number through the back window. I've gone through the images Rowan sent me last night of makes and models and shades of blue and haven't been able to narrow it down to a remotely useful range. I wasn't looking at the truck, even as I drove behind it. My mind was on the man inside, and the answers he might have to ease my suffering. There were four doors, I remember that. An open flatbed. It looked new, or well-maintained. Mostly, what I see when I remember yesterday is the man who stepped out from the driver's side after we stopped on that back road near the park. When we have the composite, we'll send it to the press and also have a team go back through the witness list. Someone else might have seen him coming or going. We cover all of the dead ends. The flowers and the gifts I dropped at Goodwill, which then either got tossed or sent to stores across the state. They were long gone, and in any case had been unopened. They could have been candles, or coasters, or chocolates. None of my neighbors remembered the truck on our street. No one knew to look. And besides that, maybe he drove a different vehicle, or dropped the gifts off after dark. None of the images from the cameras at Nichols had a clean shot of his face. Rowan jumps in now. "There's something else," he says. "It may not be related, but worth checking out." This is the first I'm hearing about anything related to the case. Rowan has kept me at bay, thinking I should focus on my family and the sessions with Dr. Landon. He had no idea how hungry I was to know more about Clay Lucas, what he was doing in Nichols that day, and how he got his hands on that weapon. "We've put together a list of everyone Clay Lucas may have had contact with after leaving his home 3 weeks before the shooting. Old friends from school, doctors, caregivers, roommates at the facilities he spent time in." Aaron leans forward. "I thought we'd been through all that," he says. "Yeah, we have. But there was one woman, an employee at the adult daycare center the family used until early last year. We haven't been able to make contact. Her name is Laurel Hayes, and she hasn't been to work since the day of the shooting. They didn't think much of it at first. A lot of people from the center were upset about it and scared to come back. Clay Lucas had been going there for months, and they have other patients with similar conditions." "But she's been gone this whole time? Over 2 weeks?" Aaron asks. Rowan tells us that her parents live in Oregon, and they were the ones who finally called the department. They spoke to her the day of the shooting to make sure she was all right. But she hadn't returned their calls 7 days later, and now 14. That wasn't like her. They said it wasn't unusual to not hear from her for a while, but she always replied when they reached out. I grab hold of this and don't let go. It feels like something, finally. And not the empty space we've been sweeping our arms through. "So someone connected to Clay Lucas has been missing since the day of the shooting?" I ask. Rowan nods.
"Yeah. Could be nothing. Could be she decided to get out of this place after what happened. Maybe she felt guilty, having taken care of Clay, not seeing what he was capable of doing. Could be she's somewhere just trying to get her head around it. Everyone at that center, Clear Horizons is the name, was pretty shaken up."
"Or maybe she's scared," I say. "What if she knows how he got the gun, or helped him get it?"
Aaron mulls this over. "Either way, it's a solid lead." "Okay, good. Good," he says. "What's next with that?"
Rowan tells him there's a unit investigating the case as a missing person. They've already gone through her apartment and called friends and coworkers. The parents are flying in tomorrow, and there's an alert out on her car, which wasn't in the lot at her building. I look at Rowan. "We should help with that." Neither man speaks. And I get it. They're worried about me. "I need to work," I tell them. And it will send a message to Wade, the 404, that he's not impacting my life. That I'm not going to stop work and run away with him, or whatever the hell he thinks he's going to accomplish. Aaron bobs his head, mulls it over. None of us has any idea what his endgame is. But that's true with every stalker. It's a powerful compulsion. It feeds a sickness inside them. They fantasize about things that will never come to be. And contrary to my argument, they rarely give up until they're made to, until someone stops them.
"Okay," Aaron says when he's done thinking. "But first the composite. That's the priority. Let's find out who our 404 really is."
Vera Pratt waits in a conference room. She's past her due date and expecting her baby with excited anticipation. I remember that feeling. I'd had it with Amy.
It changes after the first one, when you know what's coming. You remember the joy, of course, but also the sleepless nights and long, hard days. And then there is acclimating the firstborn who's been ousted from her throne as the only child. The social worker who made rounds at the maternity wing told us to expect some emotional upheaval after Fran joined our family. Amy would feel like a wife whose husband had suddenly brought home a younger version. A second wife. That's what it will feel like to her. Like a betrayal. I remembered that description fiercely when I discovered Mitch's affair. We enter the room and make brief introductions. Me, Rowan, and the guy from tech who's going to create the image of the 404 from our descriptions. Vera is a tiny woman with a big belly. She's young, long dark hair, big round eyes. You must be excited, I tell her. I have two of my own. She smiles, though there's something sad about it.
I'm tired, mostly, she says,
and I imagine the Nichols shooting has stolen much of the joy from her and her husband.
He wanted to be here, she explains. He's already missed so many days at work. I told him to go. It's not like he can help with this.
Vera Pratt had been in the men's department to buy a sweater for him. His birthday was that weekend. I've read her statement, though it felt light to me, like something was missing. She told the investigator that she'd run into the dressing room and gone to the very last stall. She'd left the door open and stepped up on the bench where people place their belongings and the clothing they removed to try things on. She did this to make the shooter think no one was in there. Wade, the 404, came in soon after. He joined her in the room and insisted they lock the door. She didn't argue with him. When he heard Rowan call out that it was all clear, he opened the door and left. She had started to have cramps and was hyperventilating, so Rowan came to her aid, laying her on the ground and having her breathe into his cupped hands. The paramedics came soon after and took her to the hospital. That was it. That was all she remembered. She never set her eyes on the shooter. I think about this and what Wade told me, how he saw Clay fall to the ground and then went into the dressing room to see about the pregnant woman, to help her. The stories don't match. But that's not why we're here, so I leave it alone. For now. We work for an hour. I have the most to offer because of the time I spent with him on that back road. The composite is close, but there's something about it that doesn't capture him. I think about his expressions, how they changed so drastically, in an instant, and how an expression can make the difference between Wade's picture being noticed or passed by. I tell the technician that we have to include his height. Anyone over 6'4" is distinct. That's something he can't hide with a smile. When the tech leaves, Rowan and Vera push back from their chairs. I know I should do the same. Get up and say goodbye. This woman has been through enough. But I can't. I don't. There's something she's not telling us. I reach out and touch the back of her hand. Can I ask you one more thing? Chapter 11. It's 4:22 in the morning. I stare at the clock on the cable box in the study. I came here thinking I might find more sleep on the sofa, as discouraging as that was after waking in a cold sweat, heart racing, head on fire. I must have been dreaming the dream for a while. Clay Lucas, his back to me. Wade, hands in the air, pleading for his life. Vera Pratt flashing by, disappearing into the dressing room. Then Clay turns. He sees me, and I see him, and Wade starts to move. Clay turns back when he catches a glimpse of this movement. I fire my weapon, but the bullet moves in slow motion. Clay turns one last time. He sees the bullet. His face is so young, and he's so scared. He opens his mouth and calls to me. Just one word. Stop. I shake off the dream and watch the numbers turn, minute after minute. I go over Vera Pratt's statement, the new one, the appendix, the one that's changed everything, the one that's caused this nightmare. I hear her voice, apprehensive at first when I told her about my conversation with Wade, the 404. He said he came into the dressing room after I killed Clay Lucas.
He said he wanted to help you, but then why would he insist on locking the door if he knew the danger had passed? She looked at Rowan as though he might save her from having to tell the last part of her story, the part she left out when she was interviewed the day after the shooting.
My husband was at the hospital the whole time. I didn't want him to know.
And there it was. The start of her confession. Rowan took the lead when he saw I was suddenly without words. He doesn't have to know. The reports are not public. Back and forth, they discussed what would happen with the story until she was finally convinced she should tell it. Then she did.
It was after he came into the stall. Like I said, he locked the door, and I whispered to him, "No, leave it open so he doesn't know we're here." I don't think he really saw me until then. I was sitting on my heels on the narrow bench, trying to be as small as I could make myself with the baby. He looked at me with surprise, or fear, like he didn't know what to do. But then he locked the door anyway. He said something about the shooter knowing we were in here, and that I should stay quiet.
She looked at her folded hands again and thought about this last part. Then she drew a breath as though bracing herself for the discomfort of her own words.
What he actually said was, "Shut the fuck up or I'll kill your baby."
Sometimes I think Rowan is made of steel because he didn't flinch. I don't know what I did, but it was more than that. A gasp, maybe. A look of shock. Wide eyes. It was immediately apparent that Vera Pratt had never spoken words like this before. She continued.
He grabbed me by my wrist and pulled me down from the bench. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know if he was the shooter, maybe trying to pretend he wasn't. I saw a movie once where a bank robber did that, took off his mask and hid among the hostages when he knew he couldn't get out. I thought maybe he was a killer. I started to feel the cramps then and the baby kicking. I couldn't catch my breath, which means he wasn't getting enough oxygen, and then I feared I was going to suffocate him, my son, and I told the man, "Please, just let me go. The baby."
But Wade didn't let her go. He held her in front of him and stood with his back to the wall. He crossed his arms around her chest so she couldn't move away. He used her as a human shield. I felt myself steel then. The alternative was to fall apart right there in front of our witness. Now I knew what he meant when he asked, "What have they said about me?" And then, "You think I'm a coward." This is why he turned on me so suddenly. He was afraid I was playing him, luring him in, that I knew what he'd done to this woman and was trying to get him to confess or maybe arrest him. I can only imagine what twisted web he'd been weaving in his depraved mind. That if I never found out what he'd done, I would feel an attachment to him that went beyond that moment on the back road. Rowan wrote everything down, asked more questions. The rest was the same. They heard Rowan call out, and Wade let her go, opened the door, and left when Rowan started tending to Vera.
"I'm so sorry that happened to you," Rowan told her.
I said the same, though my mind was on the implications of this story.
"If my husband knew," she said, "he wouldn't rest until he found this man and killed him. Please, this is his son, his wife."
Rowan told her he understood. He assured her the statement would be kept in the file, confidential, even though we both knew he couldn't promise that. We would try, both of us. But lying to witnesses had become second nature. Rowan went through the usual list of follow-up inquiries. These had already been covered in the first interview, and we got nothing new from it. I asked her one last question before we helped her up and walked her to the elevator. It was self-serving. Still, I couldn't stop myself.
"Did you hear the last shot?"
"Yes, I think so."
"Do you remember if it came before or after the man came into the stall?"
Rowan's eyes shifted from Vera Pratt to me and back again. The only good thing that had come from following that blue truck was hearing that Wade had been in the line of fire when I killed Clay Lucas, that I had taken a life to save a life, that Clay Lucas had fired at Wade right at him, not off to the side, which meant that he was there to take lives and not have someone take his. Even if Wade's actions that followed called all of it into question, it had remained a possibility. But now,
I don't remember, Vera said. But if he knew we were all safe, why was he still so afraid?
Exactly. If he'd seen Clay fall the way he told me and then gone into that dressing room to help Vera Pratt, why would he lock the door and use her as a human shield? Vera and her unborn child. Why would he pin himself against the wall, shaking with fear?
The clock turns again. It's 4:37.
I grab my phone and check the news feed. There's nothing since last night when the composite went out. It only reached the local outlets, but that was enough. We assume he is still in the area. They included his height and the description of the truck. They said he was a material witness to the shooting at Nichols Depot.
I stare at the composite. It looks inhuman, this computer-generated image.
Still, I stare at it for a long while. His face. Wade. The 404. I'm back to where I was before I followed him out of town. Back to not knowing if I needed to kill Clay Lucas. But there's no time to indulge in anguish or self-loathing. I have a bigger problem now, and all I can feel is rage. It's 4:57 when I hear a buzzing sound. I'm holding my phone, so I know that's not the source. But it is some kind of phone or device. I think through the possibilities. The alarm system Mitch installed last night, which chimes anytime a door or window opens. Does it do more than that? I go to the box in the front hall. I hear the buzz again. It is louder, but not coming from the alarm system. I think next about the smoke detectors. Maybe one is low on batteries. Only those chirp, and they chirp loudly and a minute apart. This is a buzz, and it's coming every few seconds. I follow the sound into the dining room of all places. I scan the room and see nothing, but I'm drawn to the small chest in the corner where we keep the nice linen and silver that we only use on special occasions. I open the top drawer and stop, frozen. On top of a stack of neatly folded napkins is a phone, and I think, pray, that maybe it's Amy's. Maybe she found a way to get one after we told her she was still too young. But where would she get a phone? How would she pay for it? She's only 9, and why would she leave it here? These thoughts lag behind what I already know but don't want to know. What I don't want to be real. I pick it up and see a message. I know who it's from. Open me, it says. There's an attachment. An image, which I open. It loads slowly, because this is a burner phone and it doesn't connect to the internet. I see the walls and the furniture, then the body, lying still on the sofa, covered with a quilt. I can't believe what I'm seeing. It's a picture of me, asleep in the study. It's from the first night, the night of the shooting. I know because of what I'm wearing and the quilt I'd brought from the closet upstairs. No, I think. This can't be right. The photo is taken from inside the house. I remember the next morning, the open window I couldn't explain but was too preoccupied to think about. Wade was in my house that very first night, the 404, and he was here again, planting this phone. When? How? My head spins as I stare at this picture of me, sleeping, this person standing over me. A new kind of violation covers me head to toe, and I shiver from the disgust, the repulsion. And then another buzz, a new message. Sound asleep, it says, just like a baby. And then, like little baby Doe. Baby Doe. The name given to a case decades old but solved about a year ago. A newborn baby girl was found in a dumpster outside an apartment complex. We extracted DNA from a sample of blood that was still in the file, something they couldn't do back then. We tracked down suspects who had since scattered far and wide and found a match to the mother. Once we had her, we got a confession and arrested the father, an older married man who lived down the hall. He'd picked up his newborn baby daughter and literally threw her away. How does Wade know about a case we solved a year ago? I was a stranger to him then. My name wasn't in the news about the story. I never give interviews or statements to the press. I don't like to come up in Google searches.
Think. How does he know?
I stare at the phone, waiting for a new message, but nothing comes. Hands shaking, I unlock the box that holds my gun, then race through the house, checking locks on doors and windows, checking room by room, top to bottom, like I would a crime scene. I'm careful not to wake my girls or Mitch as I look under beds and in closets, searching for the boogeyman the way I sometimes did as a child when my parents went out and my brother left me alone. It doesn't occur to me to wake my husband. This feels like something I need to contain inside myself before I tell anyone else. Mitch, Rowan, Aaron. I need to understand what it is and what it isn't. This is the curse of anxious people, prone to overreaction, overthinking. Everyone is safe, so I give myself the time to settle my nerves and let the thoughts fall into the right places. It's 5:14 when they finally do, bringing the answer.